When are people going to see that nothing ain't never going to change unless somebody finally makes up its mind to stand up and fight? Damn.
Netroots Radio presents Hopping Mad with Will McLeod and Arliss Bunny. Now, here's Will and Arliss.
Welcome to Hopping Mad. I'm Arliss Bunny.
I'm Alexis Dent.
And I'm David Paquette.
Will is still on vacation. Will McLeod is still on vacation, and we hope he's having a fabulous time. Today, I am so fortunate to have joining me both Alexis and David Paquette, who will be with us for Will's Normal Block. And I'm going to start out by talking to you about dynamic scoring, which I know you're on pins and needles waiting to hear me talk about that. Then Alexis is going to talk to you about the sexual harassment conversation that's being had around the country. David has got some really interesting stuff that has to do with health insurance and health issues in general. Then I'm coming back with a summary of an amazing article I read that I think you're really going to be fascinated by. So first up, yes, indeed, it's dynamic scoring. So years ago, when I first started out podcasting and I was still a guest on The After Show, I did a really lengthy block on dynamic scoring. And the reason I thought it was important to talk about dynamic scoring again is because we keep hearing about it. They keep referring to it in passing. And there hasn't been a lot of spelling out again of what dynamic scoring is. So I thought I would double back and talk about that a little bit because we are suiting up. We are all going to war over this conference bill. This, as I have been referring to it, the donors relief bill. And in order to fight donors relief, I think it helps us to understand some of the vocabulary. So that's why I'm talking to you now about dynamic scoring. In January 2015, strictly on party lines, the House passed a rule that designated all legislation from that point on, and by legislation I mean tax legislation and budget legislation, would be scored using something called dynamic scoring. And let's get this out of the way right up front. Dynamic scoring isn't about how much legislation will truly cost the real economy. It's absolutely not about that. If you thought it was, throw that away. Dynamic scoring is about how we evaluate. In other words, it's a procedural thing. It's about how we evaluate how much legislation supposedly costs the Treasury. So dynamic scoring is methodology. Well, actually, it's more like smoke and mirrors, but I'm coming to that. Also, for all of you MMTers out there, I will get to that part of this too, because that's really important. So scoring is a database function performed theoretically in an unbiased way by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, to determine the cost of a piece of tax or spending legislation in a manner which is, quote, and this is from their sort of marching orders, accurate, consistent, fair, and impartial, close quote. It is including, but not limited to, its effect on deficit, effect on revenues, effect on unemployment, and relatively predictable changes in behavior, things like increasing of the minimum wage, increase in legal immigration, that kind of thing. So that's what scoring is supposed to be contextualizing. Static scoring, which is the kind of scoring that we were doing before Republican math and dynamic scoring came along, static scoring does not take into consideration the entire effect on the whole economy of a given piece of legislation, including any monetary or macroeconomic implications. Static scoring essentially treats all legislation as if it only had microeconomic effects. And this is done so that legislation can be compared apples to apples. Basically, it's a way of limiting vast and generally unknowable variables so that you can really look at two pieces of legislation side by side and talk about them in terms of a consistent dollar across that legislation. So, for example, in static scoring for a highway bill, let's imagine a highway bill that's going to massively expand a given highway. Let's say it's going from two lanes to, you know, six lanes. The CBO might determine that X will be a positive effect on the heavy construction sector, but they might leave out any calculated amount of loss of housing due to the highway expansion. So it's been routine For the CBO, and this is just staggering, it's been routine for the CBO to be off by $150 billion to the positive or negative in calculations from one year to the next. In other words, we're not even talking about 10 or 15 years out. We're talking about in this year, they project for next year. And in general, they are about $150 billion off in one direction or the other. Jason Furman, writing for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, said over the past 25 years, so he's actually done the math, over the past 25 years, actual revenues in a given year have averaged $150 billion in today's terms, above or below the revenue levels that CBO predicted a year in advance. So somebody actually sat down and worked that out, and that's a hard number. So all of this means that the CBO can barely predict tomorrow, let alone 10 or 15 years out. So keep that in mind when we start talking about now dynamic scoring. Dynamic scoring imposes via legislation, they forced this upon the CBO, the factually disproven notion that tax cuts always grow the economy. So the CBO is required to factor in a false ideology about tax cuts growing the economy. And they require that the prediction of the macroeconomy go out many, many years into the future. And that time horizon varies per bill. But anyway, as the time horizon for any policy lengthens, and this is just common sense, there is an increasing inability to accurately reflect unforeseeable external drivers, right? So if they can't predict from this year to next year without having a $150 billion error, imagine 15 years from now. I mean, it's hard to wrap my head around that because it's crazy making. And George H.W. Bush called it voodoo economics. Senator Bernie Sanders, and when Sanders and Bush agree on something, you know, it has to be basically the way things actually are. Bernie Sanders says Republicans have hatched a plan to force the CBO to cook the books and paint a rosy picture of the benefits of trickle-down economics. He went on to say the purpose of dynamic scoring is to conceal, not reveal, and concluded by saying that means they are counting the chickens before they hatch. And that's absolutely the way dynamic scoring works. And so an example of this, if you want to try to picture this in your head, let's imagine that a tax cut of X is given to the top 1%, as is being done in the Donor Relief Act, the current Donor Relief Act. So a tax cut of X is going to the top 1% and to major corporations, and the CBO is forced to predict that the economy will grow by X plus Y. And because the economy is now bigger, because the economy is now X plus Y, the taxes will be X. In other words, they're trying to say that really tax cuts cost nothing. And I have a whole different reason why I'm not worried about the deficit, of course, because I believe in modern monetary theory and I know that to be the simple accounting fact of it all. But the point of dynamic scoring is that they're trying to basically make unicorns fart rainbows. It is something that's absolutely never going to happen and never going to be the case. Examples of dynamic scoring actually in use in the real world, the national embarrassment that is Kansas, the crash literally and burn of the Bush tax cuts, which the Heritage Foundation predicted would pay for themselves by 2001. And I love this, well summarized by Bruce Bartlett, who was the economist for the great GOP, you know, god, Reagan. Bartlett now says dynamic scoring is not about honest revenue estimating. It's about using smoke and mirrors to institutionalize Republican ideology into the budget process. Well, yeah, buddy, now that you're out of power, you're willing to say that. Where were you when Reagan was in the White House? Just to reiterate, dynamic scoring has never worked once under any conditions, anywhere, under any conditions at all, never, ever, never, ever worked. It's never going to, it can't, it doesn't work. Of course, House Speaker Ryan calls it reality-based scoring. And we all know that Republicans always call things exactly the opposite of what they are. So his concept of reality-based scoring means I'm lying like a rug. The entire purpose of dynamic scoring is to ease the passage of tax cuts by supposedly showing that they have a smaller impact on the economy than will actually be the case in reality. In other words, objects in the mirror are smaller than they appear. If you forget, just sit in the passenger seat of your car and look at the rearview mirror. Passing dynamic scoring back in 2015 was the first step in the GOP attack on the entire tax code. The donors relief bill, currently heading into the conference committee, is the second milestone. The real prize will be when they wrap back around in the near future, crying deficit, of course, and slash the social safety net. That's the real goal. This has been Paul Ryan's dream since he sat around at that Kager while receiving an education paid for by the social safety net and fantasized about burning the bridge behind himself. Dynamic scoring is an invention of politicians. It's purely politics. Economists, even conservative economists, are in agreement that it is not reality. So, dynamic scoring and modern monetary theory, like you can even say those two things in the same sentence. The biggest problem with dynamic scoring, as far as MMT is concerned, of course, is that it reiterates the false concept that taxes pay for anything ever. Taxes do not pay for anything. They never will. They can't. It's not the way the accounting works in the Treasury. It's simply not the way it's done. And the other big problem with dynamic scoring is that the deficit is the stick by which all things are measured, according to dynamic scoring. And, of course, MMT says nothing ever should be measured by the deficit. All tax bills and budgets have an economic overhead. It's the job of a tax, it's its purpose, to either slow the economy or mitigate personal or corporate behaviors, which are seen to have a negative societal effect, it's like a so-called sin tax. When any new tax is imposed or increased, there is some economic activity that does not happen in the private sector as a result of that, but different kinds of taxes put a different overhead load on different parts of the private sector. So in this way, personal income tax cuts are generally shown to have a more positive economic impact short term than corporate tax cuts. And of course, we all know this because additional money at the lower end of the economy gets spent, not stored or sent offshore. Meanwhile, sales taxes cause more economic slowing then does, say, something like an inheritance tax cut for this same reason. But the donors relief bill, MMT has specific problems, not with the deficit, but with the larger human welfare quotient. And that's the thing to think about. The vast sums being left in the hands of the donor class are most likely to be stored, sent offshore, or, and this is why the GOP is so enraptured, used to fund Republican campaigns, right-wing propaganda, shoving right-wing epistemology down the throats of students, and a magnitude, a multitude of other sins. One thing which is interesting about the donors relief bill, and this is something Dr. Stephanie Kelton, who's one of the leading lights of the MMT community, has taken to wondering via Twitter, and I was really surprised when I saw this go by, and she said that she thinks it's possible that the Overton window has moved for MMT as a result of the conversation that's being had around the Donor Relief Act and the deficit. And personally, I haven't seen that yet, but I am completely thrilled if she has, because she's in a much better place to know. So maybe that's a good thing, but short of that, the big takeaways, the things to really latch onto about this bill and in general about the way we talk about deficits, about dynamic scoring, about all of that, is that like every budget since FDR, lawmakers and the public are asking, how do we pay for this? When they should all be asking, what do we need? What are our values? That may not be the easier battle for us, but that's what matters now. And that is the fight we must win. That is the battle we must win. We must force the conversation to move from how do we pay for it, and that's too expensive, to what do we need and what are our values. Dynamic scoring takes the focus of legislation off the lives of almost every citizen and puts the priority on imaginary numbers strictly for the benefit of the 1% and large corporations. Dynamic scoring gives no value to investment in people, infrastructure, the environment, nothing that's important to us as progressives. There is no value in lessening inequality. And remember, this isn't just a tax bill. It's also a backdoor to taking health insurance away from 13 million Americans. So it's the health insurance, stupid. But money saved by the 1% and by corporations will not be rained down on the heads of the 99%. Personally, I'm recommending buying rain gear and preparing for yellow rain, because that's the only kind of trickle-down we are ever going to see. Alexis?
Yep, I agree with you 100%, and wow, that was really informative and a little disheartening. But yeah, in addition to that bill being a backdoor health insurance ripoff, it is also a backdoor personhood amendment and a backdoor several other things, like allowing churches to legally support political candidates without losing their tax-exempt status. And it's that whole bill is a nightmare.
Yeah, because it's not like separation of church and state are important or anything.
No, not at all. Not at all. So yeah, we've got a big, hard fight ahead of us, and we are going to have to get to it. Now, for my segment, briefly before I start, folks may have noticed a little bit of a change, that my name has changed from Joel to Alexis. And just to let everyone know that I am genderqueer, or non-binary would probably be the easiest way to say it. And so Alexis is my new name, and that's, you know, what I'm going by. So that is why that change is there. Now, what I would like to talk about is the moment that we've been having in our culture here. And this moment got started, I truly feel it got started when we elected a serial sexual harasser and assaulter to the presidency. And I feel like women everywhere just sort of said, this is enough is enough. And the dominoes has just started falling. We've seen everywhere from the halls of Washington with John Conyers and Senator Franken. And then we've seen Hollywood with your Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and the like. And even in businesses, there's local stories in local papers where harassment cases or assault cases that before would not have been noticed are getting noticed now. And we've also seen it in the media. You've got Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose. So it's everywhere. One of the things that we do have to be careful with, because it is everywhere, and I say this as a survivor of sexual assault myself, is we do have to take care that we're not re-traumatizing people who are survivors of assault and abuse by it just being such a pervasive story. I know personally I've had to back off of a lot of media simply because every single time that I see another story, it just kind of brings things back up for me. And I know that there's a lot of people out there that feel the same way I do about it, in that this is entirely a necessary thing that needs to happen. But we also, you know, should have a little caution when discussing it, you know, on our Facebook pages or wherever, to put a little, you know, just a little content warning up at the top and say, hey, you know, if this is sort of stuff that bothers you, maybe, you know, don't read it. Part of the other thing, and of course, this is mainly a politically focused topic, for me at least, because it started with Donald Trump, and I feel like it's going to end with him. But we have to look at how the two parties are going to handle the claims or the abuse or harassment cases that are going to come up. Because we already know how the Republican Party is going to handle theirs. We can look at the cases of Donald Trump, of Roy Moore, of any number of them, and see exactly what their playbook is. Step one is the age-old tactic of deny, 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 and say the accusers are liars. And step two is to just basically kind of ignore it and hope it'll go away. So on the Republican side, we know exactly what we're getting. They're going to deny everything and fight against everything tooth and nail. Now, we as progressives, of course, are not going to stand for that in our own party. And in fact, if I recall correctly, Nancy Pelosi got dragged pretty harshly after she had come out with a statement that was sort of a tepid response to the John Conyers stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, she got slammed back and forth and up one side and down the other for it, and rightfully so.
And her staff walked that back like immediately. They realized that she had put her foot in her mouth.
Oh, yeah, the backpedaling left scorch marks on the ground where the rubber
yeah.
met the road. But so we as a party know that we're not going to tolerate it. However, there's this dichotomy that's been being seen where because the Republican Party, you can be apparently an abuser and a harasser and so on and essentially suffer no consequences for it. And then on our side, you will suffer consequences immediately. What I fear, and I am strongly concerned about this, and I don't know how to go about taking care of it or protecting ourselves from it or preventing, is I fear a sort of a sexual harassment version of the Acorn or the Shirley Sherrod stuff.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean that GOP operatives, and they've already kind of tipped their hand, because remember, Republicans, in addition to what Arla said in the previous segment, where they name things the opposite of what they are, they also always accuse other people of the things that they are planning to do or are already doing. And so down in Alabama, you had the robocalls from Bernie Bernstein from the Washington Post offering women $1,000 to lie about Roy Moore. Well, I'm kind of foreseeing a situation where you're going to have conservative operatives, be it James O'Keefe or another of his ilk, or be it somebody else, you know, affiliated with the RNC or whoever, who are going to create issues. And I'm not saying that there's going to be women stepping forward who are accusing that we shouldn't believe or anything like that. What I'm saying is that there's going to be report will come out with anonymous people who haven't come forward, and they're going to say that, you know, Senator so-and-so or Representative so-and-so is a sexual assaulter and harasser. And then they'll just sit back, watch us as progressives and liberals and leftists tear down that person and, you know, demand their resignation, so on and so forth. And then by the time that person's gone from office, you know, 2 months later, just like in the Shirley Sherrod case, just like in the Acorn case, there was no there. It was all just a Republican rat, you-know-whatting operation. And we've just lost ourselves somewhat. So it's something that we have to be conscious of and very careful of, because our desire to do the right thing can be used against us, has been used against us in the past, and probably will be used against us in the future. And that's not an indictment of us us on the left caring about these sorts of things. It's more of an indictment of the folks on the right using our good nature against us.
And I think, now, you know, you and I had talked about this a little bit before the show, and I disagree with you just a little bit for one reason. And not that what you're not saying is valid, it's very valid, but I do think that the mainstream media is, you know, usually we're struggling just to get heard in the mainstream media at all. And I think they're basically enjoying this story so much that they are on it. And so I think, and, you know, I could be wrong. It would be the, you know, about the billionth time in my life. So, you know, don't be shocked and amazed. But I think that they are, you know, they are trying to listen to women, to verify what they have to say, and to be very straight about this reporting. So let's hope that that continues to be the case.
Yes, I and the Washington Post has done like an excellent job of backing up its sources and sourcing these things perfectly. But I just don't see that same rigor when it comes to, for example, CNN. But I hope that you're right. I just worry that, you know, there's going to be some manipulation of this story by the right as soon as they can figure out how to do it.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right. Absolutely. They're already on it.
Oh, yes. They're working feverishly in their lab on top of the mountain or under the volcano or wherever they happen to lair up this time.
Yeah,
bunch of
exactly.
Villains. Now, some of the other things that have happened in this wave, this tsunami of sexual harassment and assault that's been, you know, coming out, is that there have been particular ones that have kind of been passed over or kind of just disappeared silently into the ether. A lot of people don't really remember or never even heard about, for example, Terry Crews came out because he had been assaulted and harassed. And that news story was there and gone in the blink of an eye, because I believe it was right after the Kevin Spacey and just before Louis C.K. So it just kind of got thrown under the rug, and the man is in kind of bad shape. He's struggling very much. His harasser was suspended from his workplace and then 2 weeks later was back on the job. And Mr. Crews has had people who he thought were friends of his texting him, telling him that he should just basically be quiet and let it go. And what I wanted to talk about is the one thing that all of these stories have in common, whether it's Terry Crews or whether it's any of the people that Kevin Spacey assaulted or any of the women that Louis C.K. assaulted. They all have one thing in common, and that is the male predator that is doing the assaulting. Because I do see, you know, on social media, we had the huge Me Too hashtag. And one of the things that's just very much in common for everyone is that we have had for centuries, since this time immemorial, is the system where that protects, hides, and ultimately supports predatory male behavior. And it's something that I really feel like this culture is finally starting to wrap its head around and begin to address. But I also feel like that there is going to be a major backlash against this backlash, I guess, if that makes sense. And it's going to be a minefield to pick through for a very long time. But one of the things that if we can grab one thing from this moment, if we can just grab one thing and hold on to it and use it, it is the predator that is at fault 100%, not, you know, all the time 100%. Because again, speaking as someone who's been through this, I know personally the shame, the feeling that I did something wrong or I did something to invite getting assaulted. And that is something that I feel like has been socialized into us, that you know, a lot of us have been raised somehow just by virtue of the culture to feel that way. And it is something that if we can stop one thing, it is, you know, if we can stop, basically we can stop the victim blaming. Is what I'm trying to get at here, because that is the thing that keeps a lot of people silent. It kept me silent for a long time. And
it's the photo I'm going to put at the top of our blog post this week, and I'm encouraging everybody to go take a look at this thing with your very own eyes. I came out of the grocery store today after I already knew that Alexis and I were going to have this conversation. I walk out of the grocery store, and right in front of me is a red pickup truck, a full-size red pickup, with in white letters emblazoned, professionally printed on the side of the pickup, "Just grab them by the pussy, - your president." And
yeah,
I do think, and the thing I put this up, you know, I tweeted this, ladies and gentlemen, I believe we have a winner in the hard-fought race for most despicable Hoosier.
yeah, it's enraging. And the one of the reasons that I brought up Mr. Cruz is because he has, and he's spoken out about this, he's been very vocal about it on Twitter, he has spoken out about the victim blaming. Because I'm sure not everyone out there is familiar with who Terry Crews is, but he is an ex-NFL player and an actor. He's easily over 6 feet tall, weighs probably about 250 pounds, and is in excellent shape. And he was sexually assaulted. So, you know, if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone is the first thing there. But the other thing is, after he came out and told everyone about it, he had people using homophobic slurs towards him and saying that he, you know, must be gay because he was assaulted by a man. He had other people asking, why didn't you fight him? Why didn't you just punch him? Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And for a big, strong guy like that, I mean, could he have punched this 54-year-old multimillionaire producer in the face? Sure. And gone to jail. But if it can happen to him, it can happen to anyone. And if he's not being believed, or if he's being, excuse me, if he's being treated as unreliable because of this, everyone will be. And everyone has been. We all get, anytime any of us who've had an assault or a harassment speaks up about it, it gets shunted to the side. People simply don't want to believe it. And I feel like that's been socialized in this culture to just not believe the victims of this particular crime. If somebody comes up to you and says, hey, I was just mugged, the cop isn't going to say, well, what were you doing walking down the street that late at night? And why were you, you know, walking with your wallet, you know, don't you know that having a bulge of your wallet in your pants is an invitation for them to mug you? But that's the attitude that happens with the assault. And it is the main thing that I feel needs to change, because none of this is going to break wide open and get changed until we can start not blaming the people that this crime happens to.
Next up on Hopping Mad, we have David Paquette.
We're back on Hopping Mad. I'm David Paquette. Republicans in the Senate are taking another swipe at the Affordable Care Act by trying to remove the ACA's individual mandate. It is no small irony that the individual mandate was, for decades, a perennial Republican requirement, actually the only unshakable requirement in GOP plans to expand health insurance coverage, that somehow never came close to becoming law whenever Republicans were in power. Repeal of the individual mandate would undermine and collapse the state marketplaces that the ACA established. This probably explains the Republicans' sudden and complete abandonment of their own long-cherished idea of requiring personal responsibility in having health insurance, a drum they started beating in 1993. For those who are not health insurance professionals, the way insurance systems work and how insurer incentives and individuals' incentives can interact can get to be confusing. Sometimes I find it useful to compare health insurance systems to another societal structure that we pay for together and that anyone can use if and when they need to, fire departments. The instant availability and proficiency of fire departments is possible at a reasonable price per property owner because the cost is shared by everyone, including people who have never had a fire. Few people would advocate for a fire system where individual property owners could take their chances and opt out of contributing to the local fire department.
Well, if there's some kind of, you know, bacterial infection or some kind of infectious disease going around, I am better protected. Even if I have the best healthcare and the best insurance in the world, I am better protected if everyone around me is well protected.
Absolutely. Well, when we spoke about this before, you said if your neighbor's house is on fire, you're in trouble.
Exactly. Yes, exactly.
And if your neighbor's house is on fire and the fire department won't come to put it out, you're in extra special trouble.
Precisely.
If the cost of fire stations were only shared among those who volunteer to contribute, then some people would surely drop out. After all, who really thinks they're going to have a fire? At that point, either the fee per property owner for those who stayed with the program would have to go up, or the funding of the fire department would have to go down. If the price goes up, more individuals of limited means or limited foresight would opt out. That would drive the individual price for the remaining property owners still higher, prompting further cycles of opt-outs and price increases, which is a classic self-reinforcing insurance death spiral. On the other hand, if fire department funding is reduced, then the property owners and the town as a whole just end up paying more in other ways. For example, each fire department in America gets an insurance industry efficiency score based on a calculation of how well they do in limiting property losses. In case you're wondering, Las Vegas has typically rated very high on this measure, usually at the top of the list. So, the lower your local fire department's efficiency score is, the more everyone in your town pays for property insurance. And we're not
really?
Even talking. Oh, sure.
I had no idea that that was one of the metrics, one of the things that was used as a measure.
Yep. And there are also measures of the likelihood that a storm, a devastating storm will happen, or an earthquake, or a volcano, or whatever. There are regional scores for all those kinds of factors that get figured into the formula that sets premiums. And the same kinds of incentive dynamics and downstream effects apply to places where health insurance is optional. Plans soon find themselves either spinning out of premium price control into insolvency, or staying afloat by reducing medical benefits and putting the cost of care back on the consumer instead of spreading it out as insurance systems are meant to do. And we all bear the cost of the inefficiencies that our unstable, jerry-rigged system generates.
And here's the one cost people completely forget. As I was just explaining to my employees yesterday as I was passing out our Republican senator's phone number again, which is that because, for instance, my company competes all over the world, and we compete all over the world, our competitors are all in countries that, or most of them, are in countries that provide national health insurance. So
sure.
The cost of insurance isn't in the overhead that the product has to bear, but it's in my overhead. So every time the cost of insurance goes up, I get less competitive overseas.
Yep.
And that affects
sure.
raises I give my employees. It affects benefits I give. It affects hiring. It affects everything.
So you're getting destroyed by socialism, Arliss.
Yeah.
But anyway, the GOP is cynically selling the idea that not having health insurance is a basic human right. This puts taxpayers and those who do have health insurance on the hook for the medical costs that uninsured people generate, but through no fault of their own, can't possibly pay for. Beyond insurance losses, untreated illness is a measurable drain on the economy, often in ways that impact many, like lost work hours resulting in smaller paychecks and production shortfalls, but also in ways that affect only a few individuals, but with great impact, like medical bankruptcies. The best recent example of the societal cost of an uninsured population is the significant role that medical bankruptcy played in the failure of the subprime mortgage markets in 2008. Subprime mortgages were aimed squarely at people who were most likely to be uninsured, The foreclosures resulting from medical bankruptcy were an important early domino in the chain reaction that took us to the brink of depression 9 years ago. So if you believe, like the Republicans in Congress profess to believe, that the individual mandate is an intrusion on liberty and that it's all about an individual's freedom to buy only what you want to buy, think again.
Well, and when you're sitting down with, you know, crazy Uncle Liberty or whatever for, you know, a meal during this season, or if you see him in this, you know, as we're fighting about this tax plan, you might mention to him that it's going to cost him more, that all of these things, that not having his neighbor's house have fire insurance,
right,
costs him more. In other
right.
words, not having a fire department, not having health insurance, costs him. It's not what it costs you, and it's not what it costs the guy down the street, and it's not what it costs the guy he thinks is being given everything by the government. Talk to him about what it costs him, the effect on him. And I think that's the great point you're making here in terms of framing. You're talking about when, you know, bringing up this fire department frame is a way to talk to people who really don't get it about why it matters to them. Because somebody who doesn't get it, somebody who doesn't think that everybody ought to be insured just naturally, is somebody who lacks empathy. So they really don't care about whether you live or die, or whether your neighbor lives or dies, or whether their neighbor lives or dies. What they care about is whether they live or die. So
sure.
That's, you know, that's the pitch. It's how it affects them, how it affects their pocketbook, how it affects their health. Those are the things, or their job. Those are the things that matter.
Sure. I actually have more fuel for that fire with the main story that I have for today, which is also related to individual mandate. It's our almost obsessive national dependence on emergency rooms as primary physicians of last resort for the uninsured. Everybody has heard this rationalization. Since ERs will always treat anyone who shows up, then everyone has access to medical care. That idea has a very specific history. Almost 40 years ago, when ERs could turn people away, there was a particularly notorious maternal death during childbirth. She was healthy, 19 years old, 9 months pregnant, and she went into labor. She went to the nearest emergency room, which happened to be in a private for-profit hospital. There, they refused to give her care because she did not have health insurance. Instead, hospital staff called her a cab and took her to the front door to the hospital to wait for it. As she sat there waiting, her labor took a sudden turn for the worse, and she started hemorrhaging. Untreated, the bleeding quickly killed her and her unborn child right there on the front steps of a fully equipped modern American hospital, a hospital that could very easily have saved both their lives, but chose not to. Similar incidents started getting prominent play in the news. Stories made the rounds of uninsured heart attack and stroke patients being given inadequate emergency care with disastrous results. Finally, in 1986, under intense public pressure, Congress passed the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, which is known by its acronym EMTALA. As congressional bills go, EMTALA was rather short, 4 pages, but it's a very far-reaching 4 pages. First, under EMTALA, emergency rooms are required to be sure that anyone who comes in the door is evaluated for acutely dangerous conditions. Then, if the condition is dangerous, the ER must stabilize that condition before attempting to discharge or transfer the patient. It requires that any transportation of an acutely ill person must be done by means that are medically appropriate to the patient's condition. And finally, hospitals that have the expertise and technology required to treat a critically ill person must accept them in transfer and treat them to save their lives. So the bare bones of EMTALA are pretty simple, and they are totally consistent with the medical and nursing professionals' formal ethical standards, which some doctors and nurses had routinely ignored at their employer's bidding before EMTALA became the law. Conveniently, EMTALA is also consistent with common sense, which makes it very easy to explain. American hospitals are not allowed to let someone die if they can prevent it, no matter who, no matter where. Now, that's fine as far as it goes, but now here's the problem with the EMTALA mandate. To go back to my earlier metaphor, what began as something like a law requiring fire departments to put out fires that they can see with their own eyes has morphed into a general societal agreement that fire departments should work for free. So while EMTALA is humane and even ethically necessary in our system, it is a business nightmare that requires hospitals and others to spend fortunes on accounting and legal services just to get paid. In the process, they are forced to drive some of their own patients into bankruptcy. All health insurance enrollees pay higher premiums to pay for the bureaucratic overhead and to make up for the cost of care delivered but not paid for. And everybody pays higher taxes to fund government prop-up payments meant to keep the hardest-hit hospitals in business and delivering care. Hospitals and providers have responded exactly as you would expect any business to respond. They raise prices on those who could pay to make up for those losses on those who could not pay. All this distorts the incentives in the medical service and medical insurance marketplaces in myriad ways. The resulting chaos makes them underproductive and ridiculously expensive as compared to the cost of delivering high-quality, modern medical care in almost any other Western country. And the price is not just in dollars. The human cost is devastating. This is very personal for me. About 20 years ago, I had a very close friend named Danny, who was a struggling artist just getting by from week to week. One day, he asked me about some vague medical symptoms he was having. I had no clue what might be wrong with him, but I urged him to see a doctor to find out what it was. He replied by turning the empty pockets of his jeans inside out. He said, "Even if I go to the free clinic, they prescribe tests and drugs I can't afford, so what's the use?" Finally, after a year of never quite feeling well, Danny's condition suddenly worsened to the point that the rescue squad had to be called. After about $90,000 worth of futile intensive care treatment, he died. Danny was 37.
Oh my God.
His family and friends' lives were changed in ways that reverberate to this day. Without getting into the clinical details, it has always been clear to me that if Danny had been treated earlier, that is, if he had had health insurance and been able to see a doctor when I suggested that he should, he would surely be alive today. We can repeal EMTALA, and we can also be sure that no one ever gets turned away from an emergency room because they have no coverage. We can keep people from dying unnecessarily for lack of routine medical care, like my friend Danny did, and we can do it far more cheaply than what we spend now. We can do it the way Germany or Switzerland do it, or we can do it like France or Canada or Norway or England, just to name a few. There are plenty of examples of countries with modern, high-tech medical care systems that treat everyone, that do it well and in a timely manner, and that don't break the bank getting there.
And all of those systems are different from each other.
I was just going to say, no two of their systems work exactly the same way, but they all have one thing in common that we don't have, which is a very clear starting point. That starting point is a very simple rule that says health insurance is not optional, period.
I just couldn't be more correct. And as the Republicans try to use this tax bill to roll back the ACA, to roll back the individual mandate from the ACA, what they are essentially doing without saying so is destroying the ACA. And of course, And of course, the CBO has ruled. You know, the CBO has said 13 million people will lose their health care coverage as a result of this tax bill. This tax bill is a health care bill.
And those 13 million people will go back into the pool of high likelihood of medical bankruptcy, which has been way, way down, way down. But now it's gonna start to creep back up because, you know, nobody thinks that if they don't buy health insurance, it'll ruin them. And in most cases, the people who can't afford to buy health insurance anyway don't own much. So, you know, when a pauper goes bankrupt, it's not a very far fall.
And the hospital really isn't gaining anything. They drive somebody into medical bankruptcy and get nothing for their trouble.
Nothing for their trouble, yeah. And end up having to pass the costs on to everyone else.
Yeah. So we're all paying for the medical cost and the legal and the associated legal expenses, yeah.
And all the bureaucratic expenses. And, you know, I remember reading one time that the average hospital in Canada, major hospital, I'm not talking about just a little neighborhood hospital, I'm talking major hospital, have 3 people devoted to billing. In the United States, a large tertiary medical center will have 50, doing billing.
My gosh. We have got to change. We have just got to change. Okay, thank you so much, David. Bunny, and I'm back with our very first ad kind of thing, I guess you want to call it. Why just have ornaments during the holidays? Arliss Bunny and Thurston Owl, the deficit owl, are prepared to hang in with you throughout the year. They are ornaments handmade by a wonderful artisan that I came across in the Midwest. Arliss and Thurston are the modern money champions you did not realize you needed, but now must have. Available singly or together, they are Hopping Mad exclusives. After all, you came this far. Now Arliss and Thurston are just a click of fiat money away. And I just want to say that I found this artisan. She was kind enough to design exactly what I was looking for, exactly what I wanted. And she put a little McLeod family tartan scarf on Arliss. So Arliss really represents both Will and myself. And Thurston Owl, the deficit owl, for those of you who are older, you will recognize the allusion that I'm making with the Thurston Owl name. They are available now on our website. If you go to our website, up in the menu bar across the top, you'll see ornaments, Arliss Bunny and Deficit Owl. They're right there. And we hope you at least go take a look. They're super cute. We are really thrilled with them, and we hope you will be too. Once again on Hopping Mad. And as we draw down to the end of the show here, I'm going to come back on Extra Mad and talk to you about this incredible, incredible article I read. It was called The Dangerous Myth of Taxpayer Money by Raul Carrillo and Jesse Meyerson. And I met both of these guys this summer at the first International MMT conference. And remember, I think if those of you who are longtime listeners will know that the thing I said about this conference was that one of the things that struck me most about the conference was the deep involvement of activists who were focused upon a wide array of social, environmental, political issues. Well, Raul describes himself as a lefty lawyer. He works for New Economy NYC and runs the website modernmoneynetwork.org. And he's incredibly sharp driven, articulate. He's this incredibly thoughtful guy. And I really, really want to get him on the show. The same thing is true of Jesse Meyerson. I first heard him when I listened to a podcast he used to do with friend of the borough, Alexis Goldstein. But he has since relocated from the DC area to Indiana, where he provides leadership for the ever-growing grassroots organization, Hoosier Action. I love this notice Hoosier Action put up on Twitter this past Saturday. I changed the Twitter handles in this tweet so that you will know who I'm talking about. And what they said was, "We're putting Senator Todd Young, Representative Trey Hollingsworth, GOP Senate candidate Todd Roitka, and Representative and GOP Senate candidate Luke Messer, and the rest of the Indiana politicians behind this evil, immoral, unjust tax scam on notice. We're coming for you." And at the end of this statement that continued from there, they said, "We will get organized, take action, and transform politics of our state and country, town by town, block by block, Hoosier by Hoosier." The article I'm going to talk to you about was published the 19th of October, 2017 in Splinter News. It's absolutely fabulous, and I hope you'll come back on Extra Mad and listen to it. Folks, thank you so much for joining us today on Hopping Mad. Next week, Will will actually be back, which I'm thrilled about. We send out our thanks to Netroots Radio, to our show's editor, our fabulous editor, Michelle LeSure, and especially to you, our listeners, for joining us here today. You can find the broadcast version of Hopping Mad on Netroots Radio at 8 a.m. on Mondays, the full podcast version of our show, usually including a free extended interview, which we call Extra Mad. The podcast can be found on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, and other internet podcast apps. Our website is imhoppingmad.com, and you can listen to, download, or comment on the show there. I got this cool comment on our last show, our last live show, about dairy farms, and it really made me think. And I walked around for like 3 days with that comment in my head, and I thought about it and thought about it, and then sent back an email on it, and It really made me think about a lot of interesting things. So please feel free, and I welcome comments and conversation. It's really wonderful. You can find us on Twitter at I'm Hopping Mad. You can find Will on Twitter at WillMcLeod99, and I'm there as Arliss Bunny. Hopping Mad is your place on Progressive Radio for deep dive down the rabbit hole coverage of politics, economics, and of course, carrots. With Extra Mad. I'm Arliss Bunny, and I really, really miss Will. Doing these kinds of things alone is not nearly as much fun as having Will with me. And I know he would have a lot to say about this article too, so I really wish he was here. But the article I'm talking about is The Dangerous Myth of Taxpayer Money by Raul Carrillo and Jesse Meyerson. It appeared in Splinter News in October, on the 19th of October, and I will put the link for it in our blog post, and I encourage you to take a look at it, but I am basically going to go through the whole article. I never do this. I've done it, I think, only once before on the show, but I thought what they said was so well put that I just didn't think I could say it better or summarize it any more clearly than they've done. I do have some additional commentary, of course, because that's just me. So here we go. Quote, "There is no such thing as public money, only taxpayer money," close quote. Margaret Thatcher, 1983. When Vice President Mike Pence flew home to Indiana earlier this month, and remember again, this was October, it was to pull off a publicity stunt censoring protests against racist policing. And remember, this was the anti-NFL players kneeling. It was that trip. So anyway, so back to the article, sorry. A publicity stunt censuring protests against racist policing. Rather than dragging him for this, however, take after take zoomed in on a different offense altogether. Pence's, quote, "wasting of taxpayer money," unquote. The writers in question may have told themselves they were hurting Pence by exposing his hypocrisy, but by using the taxpayer money frame, they were spreading, however unwittingly, a racist, sexist, classist myth. Although most of us pay taxes, and here I'm going to interject, folks, all of us pay taxes. There's no most of us paying taxes. All of us pay taxes. Sales tax, which is extremely regressive, the most regressive of all the taxes we pay, is impossible to avoid. So most of us pay taxes. That's not quite accurate. All of us pay taxes. They may be talking about income taxes, and that's, of course, something that most of us pay. Back to the article. Although most of us pay taxes of some kind, every time we say taxpayer money, we prolong the illusion that society depends on certain kinds of people so we can have nice things. And I had never quite thought of it that way before, but I think that's exactly right. I think the way they phrased that is really clear. It's excellent framing. Back to the article. One quick exercise shows why. Picture a taxpayer. What does one look like? A homeless black trans teen? An immigrant day laborer waiting on the corner? A young mom trying to cobble together enough income to feed her family while languishing on disability backlog? Unlikely. Let's be honest. We know what sort of people taxpayers are supposed to be, and they're not the ones we should be casting as the aggrieved parties. Here, I'm interjecting again. Here, I disagree with this framing just a little bit. White so-called middle-class taxpayers are screwed by things like the donor relief bill. The issue isn't that they do or do not have related grief. The issue is that the lens is much too myopic. When it talks about taxpayers, it's a much too myopic lens. And if it's limited just to, you know, the white middle class, and the issue is that we're missing the concept of all of us. It's about all of us. And when we allow ourselves to become divided into tiny little pods, then that's when we get what we've got right now, basically. We've allowed them to fissure us apart, and that is not who and where we want to be. Back to the article. Calling public money taxpayer money implicitly affirms that taxation is theft. If the money is taxpayers by right, what business does the government have using it for healthcare, jobs, or clean water? If we're looking out for taxpayers and not the public as a whole, we are favoring wealthier groups over poorer ones. White people over black people, men over women, U.S.-born people over immigrants, and so forth. We are hiding how the economic order relies not merely on the sacrifices of taxpayers, but the contributions of debtors, tenants, workers, and countless other actors. We are perpetuating the politics behind the 1970s California taxpayers' revolt, and I was there. My parents walked door to door on that sucker, and it was incredibly frustrating. Anyway, we're perpetuating the politics behind the 1970s California taxpayer revolt, the 1980s demonization of welfare queens, and the Make America Great Again movement, faux populism that suggests the great majority rely on the wealthy rather than vice versa. I thought that was a particularly relevant point given what's going on with the Donor Relief Act right now. Back to the article. Not only is the taxpayer money framing damaging, it doesn't reflect how public spending actually works. A household or a business may have to stash or borrow money before it can spend any, but we are users of the currency. The U.S. government, which is the issuer of the currency, works differently. Congress votes to spend new money or something. Then the Treasury and the Federal Reserve credit the relevant bank accounts, and that's it. And folks, this is me again. Of course, anybody's listening to this program for any length of time has heard me say almost these exact words over and over and over again. I love hearing other people say it. Anyway, back to the article. The government has spent new money into existence. Later, Congress may tax old money back out of existence, but it isn't collecting money in order to spend it. It's offsetting earlier spending. It may also offset spending by bumping student loan rates, policing for profit, or various other activities. Although Congress taxes everyday people too heavily, calling public money taxpayer money makes as much sense as calling it student debtor money or suspicious driver money. Look at a dollar bill, and you'll see that the signatures of its creators, not taxpayers, but public officials who let the taxpayers hold it in the first place. This is the best line ever. This next line, best line ever. Money doesn't grow on rich people. We should heavily tax the billionaire class so we can stop living in an oligarchy. But we don't need private capital for public spending. And my commentary again, using taxes, and I spoke about this earlier in the show, this is using tax as a mitigator for social ills. In other words, it's using tax not to buy something or to pay for something. It's using tax to prevent oligarchy. That's the point. To prevent inequality, to further democracy. That's the value of taxing the 1%. The value of taxing the 1% is not that we get their money, it's that we take their money. Back to the article. Margaret Thatcher's mantra was backwards. There is no such thing as taxpayer money. Only public money is what she should have said. Modern money is a creature of the public, and we use it for public power. This is how, me commenting on this, this is how activists are framing MMT in the vocabulary of their priorities. So I'm going to read that again. Modern money is a creature of the public, and we should use it for public power. Back to the article. We are all the public, and we deserve a clear, equal say in how our economy and society work. No matter how much we each pay in taxes, it's time to claim our democratic rights. There is more than enough housing for the homeless, food for the hungry, medicine for the sick. There is enough low-carbon emission technology to transform our energy system, quit exacerbating the climate crisis, and hire unemployed people all in one fell swoop. And there's more than enough public money to manage it all. And me again, this is why MMT is critical. And I have said this many times and I'm going to keep saying it. This is why MMT is critical. It isn't the procedural stuff that I so frequently talk to you about when I'm explaining how modern monetary theory works and how the mechanism of it works. That's not actually the important part. It helps you to understand it, but what it's useful for. The reason it's important that you understand it, the reason I take this time every week to try to talk about modern monetary theory is that the procedural aspects I speak of so often are the servant of societal good. They are the servant of the kinds of things these activists are trying to make happen. So understanding modern monetary theory is understanding how to empower the kinds of things that we want to see happen in society. Back to the article. And I found this really interesting. Exposing hypocrisy may feel good, but it does little actual good. The people who primarily identify as taxpayers are Trump and Pence's base, constantly repeating that their taxpayer money is being wasted, only pressures them to violently defend their property as the system encourages us all to do under stress. And this is me again talking. I really thought this was insightful. This is boots on the ground perspective, and you don't hear this coming out of academia, which is why I think the effort of the MMT leadership to empower activists has been especially essential. And I think now there is gathering so much momentum under the modern monetary theory, the modern money framework, that activists are teaching activists. It's not even going from academic to academic anymore. It's going from activist to activist. And that's when it gets powerful. That's when the boulder really starts to roll. So back to the article. Yelling, "Who's the paid protester now?" an America's most basic bigot feels therapeutic, but it is not powerful. And my commentary again, the best activists, they have their fingertips pressed to the wrists of powerful memes, actions, framing, and organization. And these two young men who have written this article are among those people. So when they say this is not powerful, they know from whence they speak. And I trust their insight and their recommendation. Back to the article. For over 40 years, Democrats have chided the GOP for fiscal hypocrisy. What do they have to show for it? For over 40 years, Republicans have controlled the conventional wisdom around budgets, successfully using the taxpayer money myth to force Democrats to starve the beast, i.e. cut social spending to actually starve children and veterans and many others. And as I'm just adding into this, or as the donors relief bill is putting in play, cut health insurance for 13 million people, and some not insubstantial percentage of those people will die unnecessarily. Back to the article. Calling bluffs didn't get Merrick Garland confirmed. It didn't get the GOP to buy into the Heritage Foundation healthcare plan, and it won't wean support from Mike Pence's racist political theater. Everyone knows the Republicans are hypocrites and liars, just like everyone knows Donald Trump is a con man, a pig, and a megalomaniac. Yet Republicans now control 68 state legislatures, 34 governorships, and nearly every facet of the federal government. When we reinforce the right wing's racist, sexist, classist frames in an attempt to expose hypocrisy, we lose. If instead we root our politics in what is good and bad, just and unjust, moral and immoral, we can win. That's the end of the article, and I just want to recommend to you that you go back and read it again, that you share it with your friends, that you pass it around a bunch. This is the kind of framing, the kind of talking about framing that we need to get out into our community as wide as possible. I will be talking more, and I've talked about framing in the past. I'll be talking about it more in the future. I took a lot of really good notes in a framing session at the MMT conference this summer, and I haven't even had time to get to talking about that yet. I will, and we will all sort of collectively go on that journey and figure out how best to talk about these things. But I think this groundwork laid by Raul and Jesse is terrific and extremely well done. I really recommend it to you. Thank you for joining us today on Hopping Mad. It was my pleasure to spend time with you. We'll see you next week when Will is back.